Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Marie Desjardins to our show. Dr. Desjardins is Dean of the College of Organizational, Computational, and Information Sciences at Simmons University in Boston, Mass. Hi, Marie. I'm so glad that we have you on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell me a little bit about your college and also why students select Simmons University?
Sure. So Simmons, I like to start talking about Simmons with their mission, which is to provide transformative learning that links passion with lifelong purpose. And I think Simmons really, since its founding in 1899, has been an institution that's focused on this mission. Simmons started as a women's college that was intended to offer women an independent livelihood at a time when women weren't necessarily trained or prepared in that way. We're now a thriving university with a women-centered on-campus undergraduate residential program, but also a number of large and thriving graduate programs in different areas, both on-campus and online. And we're about to launch a fully online undergraduate degree program called Complete Degree in partnership with 2U that I can talk about some. And I think students come to Simmons because we infuse civic engagement and a sense of social justice and socially responsible leadership with a focus on preparing students for a successful and prosperous career in whatever field they go into. So there's kind of a combination of theory and practice of particular technical skills with career-oriented skills and leadership skills. And I think students come because they're looking for that type of experience.
Oh, that's great. So as we look, you know, as we get over this year, you know, 2020 is behind us. What do you think is going to be new for Simmons in 2021, 2022?
Right. Well, the thing that's, you know, on my horizon and that I spend time on really every single day because we're running up to this very quickly is the launch in May of our Complete Degree undergraduate programs. And we'll be starting the program with five degrees, two of which are in my college. So part of the reason I came to Simmons was because I was excited about this college. And as you said, it's the College of Organizational, Computational, and Information Sciences, which is a lot of words, a lot of syllables, and not very familiar to people because I don't know any other university that brings those disciplines together in one place. But thinking about the intersection of organizational behavior, information, computation, everything from AI and machine learning to diversity and equity in organizations all kind of falls under my umbrella. So the two degrees in the Complete Degree program within my college are a business and management major and a computer science major. And we'll be launching other majors as we go forward, but that's our first set of cohorts. So that's kind of probably our biggest focus right now because it's a big lift to launch new degree programs, and we're actively recruiting for those programs and developing new courses that are especially designed for adult returning students, which is the target, which is a little different from our traditional on-campus undergraduate population. We're also looking forward to, I hope, a return to campus. We've been entirely online since the middle of March last year with just a few very specialized programs like physical therapy and some of our science and clinical labs on campus. So we're all looking forward to getting back to campus, and we'll actually be coming back into, for my college, a newly renovated space in a different building, which has been configured and we're moving into as part of a complete campus transformation called One Simmons. So we are really renovating and upgrading and modifying all of our buildings with two particular goals. One is to build a new state-of-the-art science center So that's kind of the first project that's starting to launch now that we've got all these other enabling moves underway. And then the next phase of the project is to build a residential tower and living and learning community on our main campus. Our residential campus is currently located a few blocks away from our main campus. So that's another just, honestly, you know, once in a lifetime kind of transformation of a campus that's happening in the physical plant. And so we're really going to be rolling on that project starting in the coming year. Then the other big change for us is we have a new president, Lynn Perry Wooten, who joined us in July of 2020, so just a few months ago. We currently have an interim provost and are nearing the end of our search for a permanent provost who will start this summer. We also are either just started or is about to start. I'm not sure when her actual start date is, a new vice president for student affairs. We're hiring a new CFO. And I believe there's another search about to launch for another senior level cabinet position. So it's just, it's a lot of change and transformation. And I think that it's challenging because change is challenging. And people, even people who want change, also like things the way they are and like stability. And in the middle of the pandemic, we are already, you know, everyone is facing a lot of uncertainty and instability. So managing all of that change is, I think, my largest challenge as a leader, is just keeping people together, keeping them grounded, keeping them feeling positive and optimistic and confident that we will meet all the changes. But they're great changes, and they really show, I think, Simmons' continued commitment to adapting to the world around us and to innovating and changing, but always coming back to that core mission that I mentioned at the beginning, providing transformative learning that links passion with lifelong purpose. And I have it written down in a couple of different places so I can keep going back to it. And that's really at the core of everything that we're doing.
That's exciting. So let's go back to, you mentioned five programs, but two of them are in your college. So let's talk about those. So these degree completion programs. So let's walk through those a little bit better.
Yeah. So the idea is to provide a Simmons education to adult learners, women, who many of whom may already have some college credits. Currently in our first cohort, we're really recruiting students who have an associate's degree or the equivalent. So they've had some college, and then maybe they've been in the workforce. Maybe they had a baby. Maybe they had to take care of their parents or, you know, other members of their family. Maybe they had to go into the workforce sooner than they had expected to, just to make ends meet. And so we're really looking at that population and recruiting them into our programs that are very focused on preparing them to sort of accelerate their careers. So wherever they are, it may be for a computer science degree, I'm sure we'll have some people who are already working in the field of computing who maybe have been to a boot camp, or yes, maybe they've found their way into a programming job or a technical job of some kind, but without the degree experience and without the foundation of all of the conceptual skills. And we'll take those students along with maybe somebody who has been working in construction or in retail who's never taken a computer science class in their lives, but has heard about it and is wondering what that's all about, and will help them move into this field and find success. Because I think all of these fields should be open to anybody who has a passion and an interest in making a difference in the world. People don't always think of computer science as making a difference in the world, but of course, look at the world, you know, look how we're talking to each other. Computing has completely transformed the world around us. And I think the more we can get different kinds of people into that field to keep making that transformation focused on making the world a better place for people, the better off we'll all be.
So the majority of these students are already come in with an associate degree. Is that what you said?
In the first cohort, that's what we're aiming for, but we'll be expanding the program really to welcome students who have some college credits or potentially have no college credits at all, never went to college and are maybe a little bit older and thinking that they'd like to go and find a way to do that. The reason to do these programs online is because it expands access. Right. It expands access for us to people who can't necessarily commute to campus, who may be working full-time, who may be living in Wyoming or Illinois or anywhere, and would like to have access to the education that we offer. And we've done that very successfully with our graduate programs by having both on-campus programs and online programs expanded the type of students that we're able to reach. And that's really the goal with the undergraduate online programs.
So since these are going after adults or working adults, as you said, will there be certificates, micro-credentials along the way that can help them in the workplace?
You know, we're talking about that. I think we're focused right now on transforming our existing degree programs into an online format.
Okay.
And then the next step is really to think about what is the market for different kinds of stacked credentials, for coursework, for sub-credentials, and what does the work world, what does industry actually look for in those? I think there's a lot of places that are generating credentials, but if industry isn't wanting to consume those credentials or recognize them, they don't necessarily have a lot of currency. And I think that landscape is still evolving so fast. We know the quality of our undergraduate degrees in these areas. Our students who graduate from our on-campus programs have extraordinary career outcomes. And that's what we intend to provide for our online undergraduates. But we are thinking and talking about what other kinds of students who maybe don't want a complete degree or don't have the time for that yet. How can we identify milestones along the way that might help them, even if they are making slower progress or they're taking it one course at a time or a few steps at a time?
You know, I think that's a great idea. I think going for access first is a wonderful idea. And then I agree with you. I talk to colleges all the time that are providing certificates, but at the end of the day, what's that certificate get that student when they come out? And so I love the idea of talking to industry, find out exactly. So you can kind of baby step in there and really mold your program the right way.
Right, right. What's going to be meaningful and what's going to have value? Because, you know, for a student to spend the money and take the time to go and work on a degree or a certificate or any credential, we know that's a big investment for them. And so that return on investment is the absolutely essential thing. If we can't provide return on investment, then it's not the right thing to do.
Correct.
And so that's what we're going to be looking for in these programs.
Great point. Well, let's talk a little bit about you. It's always, for sometimes when I ask that question, a lot of people would rather talk about their school and their programs, but can you talk a little bit about yourself and how you became an academic leader at Simmons?
Sure, sure. You know, I grew up with parents who were very academically inclined. They met in college at Catholic University, and they were just always teaching us. You know, we were always learning something every minute of the day. Everything is a quiz. Everything is, you know, an observation, a question, an inquiry. So I kind of grew up with that mindset and always expecting that I would go to college and graduate school. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but late in high school, I ended up taking a programming class, Fortran programming, on punch cards at the local community college, actually. And I just loved it. It combined my love of sort of puzzles and math and problem solving with a real kind of creativity and design opportunity that I didn't know that was what computer science was about. I think a lot of people still don't know that's what computer science and programming are about. It's, you know, it's puzzles and problem solving defining a problem in a way that lets you solve it and kind of having a language for doing that. And I find that I bring that to everything that I do. So I went off to college. I'm sitting in Brookline, Massachusetts right now. And I came to Cambridge, Massachusetts and got my college degree at Harvard. And then I went to Berkeley for a PhD in computer science, which is what I was supposed to do. And then I was supposed to go be a professor. And towards the end of my PhD, I realized I don't know how to be a professor and I'm not sure I'm ready for that. It was a very competitive market at the time. And so I decided to look for positions in research labs. And I very quickly landed, my very first interview was a few weeks later and I got an offer. So I interviewed for exactly one job. And I spent about 10 years at SRI International, which is a research lab in Menlo Park, California, which was great. It was a great experience. I loved being there. I loved the people I worked with. I had children while I was there, flexible work environment. I have two wonderful adult children now to show for it. And it was just the perfect place for me to be. But after a while, I missed students and teaching, which I love doing. And so I decided it was a good time for me and my family to apply for academic positions. And I ended up with a couple of offers, but the one that I accepted was at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, which is located a few miles from the house I grew up in Columbia, Maryland. So that kind of seemed like a sign. So I moved back to Maryland and I was at UMBC for 17 years. I was an assistant professor and then I was tenured and became a full professor and started taking on leadership roles. And I gradually realized that I had gotten stretched very thin. I loved teaching. I am going to say that I think I'm a great teacher. Sorry, I wasn't sure. I'm like, how do I put the right words for that? I'm a great teacher. I am. I'm very good at it and I love doing it. I think I'm a really good research mentor and I've been very happy mentoring students and publishing and working with them. In fact, that's what I love most about research is not the research itself. It's working with the students and helping them see what they can accomplish. And I was in more and more leadership roles, both at UMBC and also statewide, leading an initiative to bring more computer science to the K-12 schools. And that that really became a labor of love over about a 7-8 year period that culminated with the founding of the Maryland Center for Computing Education that in the year that I left UMBC was funded with $5 million from the state legislature. So that was like kind of my pinnacle of that. But I was doing all of these different things and it was just too much. And so I decided I needed to take some time to figure out how to choose between these different things. And I was fortunate enough to have UMBC sponsor me into the American Council on Education Fellows Program. And so I was an ACE Fellow in 2014 to 2015. I spent a semester with Lori Leshin, who was then the brand new president at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And that was an amazing and really transformative experience for me. I think I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about leadership and universities and how they work. And I realized that I could do more and have more impact by kind of moving up that leadership path than I could by staying in the classroom. And I had to choose. I knew I couldn't keep doing both. So I went back to UMBC and I became an associate dean. I had a wonderful dean who recruited me, Julie Ross, who's now the dean of engineering at Virginia Tech. And that was a great experience. And it just kind of gave me a taste. And I thought I'd really like to keep doing this. And started looking around and the position at Simmons. Honestly, when I came to Boston for the interview, I didn't think that that's where I was going to want to go. It was such a different place from UMBC, I thought. But it turns out that the core mission is the same. It's focused on diversity. It's focused on making a difference in the world and being wonderful educators and doing research in the service of that mission. And I just fell in love with it, you know, from the time I came to campus. And luckily at the time they fell in love with me too. One of my favorite anecdotes is I got on the train after the interview to not to head back home, but to head to Stamford, Connecticut for the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. which I had been going to every year for about six to eight years. I don't remember at that time. And I had the best competitive crossword puzzle year I ever had. I came in 14th and won the B division finals, which is, if you know crossword puzzles, this is like, you know, this is the pinnacle of success for a B player, which is
That's
what I
great.
Am. Yeah. So that was kind of my journey. And I ended up at Simmons and that's been its own journey.
So, are you teaching right now then as a dean?
I am not teaching right now. I have thought a lot about it. In fact, at one point, I thought that I might teach an artificial intelligence course in the computer science department. And then I wasn't sure I was going to be able to find the time. And then the pandemic hit.
Right.
I can't do it. Two of the other four deans at Simmons have taught a class. Mm. And I admire them for fitting that in because I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to balance that with everything else. I miss it.
Yeah, that's what I've seen. Because you're just so passionate about what you're talking about. So I can imagine you being a phenomenal teacher in a classroom.
Thank you.
But on the same token, you still have to take care of a college. And I've watched people really struggle with that. So that's why I asked the question. I can just tell you kind of want to get in there, but you still have to pay attention to your college. So
yeah, maybe next year. We'll see.
So in reviewing your bio, I see that you research in artificial intelligence. So can you share your view on the implications of AI in higher ed and also society in general?
Sure. You know, I got into artificial intelligence in college because I was a CS major and I took an intro psych class and I just became fascinated with how the brain works. And I thought, I wonder what you could do with a computer. And I discovered this field of AI and I'm like, this is great. I'm going to go into AI. At the time, AI was like this niche area. I mean, nobody heard of it. I mean, there were people doing AI, but it wasn't, you know, you wouldn't go out into the world and say it and have people say, oh, AI, that's really cool. I know all about that. And now it's hot. You know, you see like billboards for machine learning and people are saying, yeah, we bring AI to the world. And it's pretty exciting. It's very exciting to see that. I think there's a lot of wonderful things about the emergence of AI and the opportunity for AI and machine learning to have a positive impact on the world. I think there's also some challenges and some dangers. And I think that the community is grappling with those and talking pretty frankly about some of the limitations of the technology and some of the ways in which when you have one technology that kind of hits and becomes phenomenally successful, for AI, it's deep learning, that becomes kind of the yardstick for everything. Mm. And sometimes, the thing about a yardstick is it's one dimensional. The world is multidimensional, it's infinite dimensional. And so when you have a yardstick that you're measuring everything by, and you've laid it out in one axis, you can't even measure the other axes. And so I think just thinking, how do you get people to stay excited about the direction that you're going in that's really exciting, but also get them to look up in the sky and think about what they could do if they could fly. Like you've got a really fast car, but maybe we can invent space flight. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can, you know, get down into the nanomolecular level. You want to keep the excitement about the directions you're going in, but you also want to kind of think about, well, we need to build some brakes onto this super fast car because it might hit somebody. And we need to think about other forms of transportation and other problems. So I think there's some issues with the inherent bias that is built into machine learning systems. I actually wrote an article about bias in machine learning. I guest edited a special issue of Machine Learning Journal on bias in machine learning in, I think, 1994, maybe. Hmm. And again, it was sort of a niche problem then, but now it's a core problem. And the core problem is you can't have machine learning without bias. Inherent, that's how machine learning works. That's the definition of machine learning. You take you take data and you apply a bias to it to extract a pattern.
Sure.
The bias is what's the data and what kind of patterns are you looking for? Bias is inherent in the process and you can't get rid of bias because that's how it works. So you have to acknowledge the bias, and you have to make sure that the bias that you're building in is in fact the bias that you want. And you have to, like, I don't know, you have to put a label on it. Like, we put a label on the coffee cake I had this morning. It said what was in it, and I can choose whether that's the coffee cake I want to eat or not. So I think we're, you know, these are challenging problems, but the field is grappling with them. And so I hope that we'll keep addressing some of the limitations, and we'll think more about diversity and equity and who owns technology and who it benefits, because those are really important things for us.
So then if I was a college president and somebody said, let's talk about AI, and my response is, I don't know how that fits into my college. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So there's an increasing number of tools out there for using analytics to try to facilitate, you know, higher ed operations and student success. True in every industry, right? Ways to use analytics to do things better. I would say we absolutely have to be building a strong data infrastructure so that we have the data that we need to understand our students' performance, our faculty performance, our financial performance, our organizational performance. And we have to use analytics to look at that data. And we have to do what I just said, which is to know what it is that we've actually asked and what it is that the data and the analytics can actually tell us, and make sure that we're not laying more into that process than it can carry. So for example, I've seen tools that predict the probability that a student will graduate. That sounds great. Like, that's really helpful, you know, because some students graduate and some students don't. But as soon as you put that label on that student, and you say, well, that student is 40% likely to graduate based on, you know, whatever past experience. Well, now that student's got a 40% label on their head. Is that helpful? You know, who does that help? Who needs to know that? And what does that 40% mean? Because of course, the purpose of putting that 40% label on them is not to put the label on them. It's to change that to 100%. Right. So I think that we just need to be really thoughtful about how we roll out these kinds of tools and acknowledge their limitations. And that when we apply analytics to a group, especially a group of people, that we understand that we can only talk about broad patterns, and we can only talk about similarities to past experience. There was a very prominent case that happened recently where a university was using some analytics tools to help evaluate applicants for graduate school. Well, it turns out that the way they trained that was with data from evaluations of previous applications. And guess what? The analytics approach had baked in whatever biases the humans had. So now, whatever biases you've had are in your system, and they're going to be, then now they're going to just start self-reinforcing each other. So it just makes it very hard to change the way you're doing things when you're using tools that are based on analyzing patterns from how you've done things in the past. The same is true with credit scoring systems and a lot of other potential applications. Marketing, you know, well, boys are more likely to buy computer games, so we should market to boys, because boys are more likely to computer games, so we should market to boys. Well, how do you get out of that kind of cycle is I think really the question.
You know, I've never thought about this until you said that, as far as, you know, I'm thinking of a recruiter or student services, or even using ACT scores to bring somebody into the campus. That has nothing to do with that one student's going to be successful or not successful. It's just, I love that term bias. I think that's the best way to look at it. I've never thought of it that way. So I guess from a higher ed standpoint, it just makes people have more of a broad view of what they're looking at, instead of kind of silo in on a few numbers to, wow, that's really interesting.
Thank you.
Well, and then in society, as you say, it's the same thing for marketing and things like that, correct?
Right. And the thing is, I think the thing that I try to say to people as often as I can, bias is not bad. It's what we do with bias that's bad. And it's not understanding our biases and not being willing to acknowledge them and talk about which biases we want to have and which ones we don't want to have. That's what causes trouble.
Yeah, especially in a university system where in qualitative research, we're very careful of having bias in our own research. And so you're really just setting it straight across the board for everybody to kind of look at it the same way on everything. That's a great idea. Let's change a little bit on our topic now, and let's talk about another thing that you seem to be passionate about, and that's diversity in computing. So why do you think that is so important, and what can be done to reach that goal?
Right. I think this is a multidimensional equity issue that, first of all, you know, from just a pragmatic economic perspective, there is so much evidence, and it grows every day, that diverse teams produce better solutions. Just in general, you know, if you're going to build a car or a phone or a pen, the more different kinds of minds you bring to working on that product or that problem, the more robust your solution is going to be. And I think there's, like, you can model this as a computational approach and say, well, yes, of course, the more of the design space you consider and explore, the more likely it is you are to hit on a really high quality solution. But engineering teams tend to be very non-diverse. And the challenge is that non-diversity recreates non-diversity, because people also have a bias, a natural human bias towards wanting to be around people who are like them. Everybody wants to be around people who are like them. It's comfortable, it's easy. It's just something that we seek out as human beings, as living beings. And yet, there's some really interesting simulation tools. There's something called the parable of the polygons. I encourage anybody who wants to go Google that and look it up. Parable of the polygons. And it's a little simulation environment that lets you set up a little community of squares and triangles. Maybe there's circles and triangles, I forget. And you can vary the degree to which these shapes want to be around other shapes like themselves or around shapes that are different from them. And it turns out that actually you can be very robust to an in-group preference if you also have some out-group preference. So it's not harmful to society for people to want to be around other people like them, as long as they have also some degree, and it can be a smaller degree, of also wanting to be around people who aren't like them. So what's happened in computer science is that in the 80s, when I was in college, like many other STEM disciplines, the number of women in computer science was increasing. That was true in medicine, it was true in law, it was true in all sorts of things. And, you know, that was happening partly because the generation before me broke down a lot of barriers and said, we are equal. We're human beings, and we're all in society together, and we should all have access to the same kinds of opportunities. And I think people today mostly believe, not everybody, but most people believe that. But what happened in the 80s was there were a number of societal influences that caused women to be less likely to become computer scientists. In other words, in the 80s, the percentage of computer science degrees that went to women peaked at around 35%. And instead of continuing to go up like every other field of STEM, every other field basically continued to go up and is, you know, some of them are higher and some of them are lower, but all of them are kind of headed in that direction. Computer science, you can just see this decline all throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s. And I could talk, we could do another whole podcast on why that happened, and I won't try to get into causes, but I think it's clear that it did not happen because women don't like computer science or aren't good at it. You know, and I still hear, even today, I hear people say, well, if women wanted to do computer science, they would just do computer science because anybody can do anything they want. It's like, yeah, but no, that's not really how the world works. You know, really how the world works is that people are shaped by so many different influences. And to some extent in our society, I think women are sometimes shaped more by those influences than men are, because we are also raised, we women are raised to please other people and to avoid risks and to play it safe. This is just, you know, these are cultural norms for our society, is that women should be nice and they should be pleasant and they shouldn't lead to conflict and they should do what they're told. And they should, you know, if they fall down, somebody needs to run and protect them because, you know, they can't, they're fragile. These are still beliefs that we hold, I think, pretty deeply in ourselves, even when we don't intend to. And so I think all of those different messages just come in and really keep women out of the field. And now it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because there's also this chicken and egg problem, that it is very hard to go to a company that is heavily male dominated and be one of the very few women. And I know even in really well-intentioned companies, I know so many women who have gone and said, well, could we do things this different way? Or what if we tried this? And have just been shot down and like, well, that's not how we do things here. Well, you're soft, you know, you're soft, you're weak. Yeah, girls can't program, whatever, you know, those kinds of messages. They're just very persistent. So how do we get past that? Well, we have to work on cultural. We have to work on culture. We have to do leadership training for both men and women. We have to understand these trends and talk about them. And we have to start really early in elementary school and middle school, helping everybody believe that they are not just users of technology who can like type on their phones and, you know, use Uber, but people who could create the next technologies. And I think we just haven't always sent those messages. And so that's really why I worked so hard in Maryland towards expanding computing access. And really there's a great national movement called Computer Science for All, CS for All. And it just says computer science is for everybody, and it should be for everybody, and everybody should learn something about computer science. And, you know, and maybe at some point, if that is infused enough in our curriculum, it becomes more something that everybody owns, and people don't have to be invited into, they can just naturally explore different things.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think when you look at diversity, everything goes back to K-12 almost. You have to really start early. And then I think for right now, though, if that is not happening, then what can student advising or student services do for a student to make sure they're going down the right path and or a path that they want to do instead of a hole they're supposed to be pegged in?
Yeah. I have a wonderful former, a lot of wonderful former students, as you can imagine, all over the place. But one in particular, who I worked with as an undergraduate, started out as she went through three or four different majors before she landed in my class, which was designed for non-majors. And she came to me partway through the semester and said, I really like this kind of coding stuff. And she ended up switching to the version of the course that was for computer science majors, and then deciding to maybe do a minor, and then deciding to change her major. And she's now a PhD student in computer science at Carnegie Mellon. And I don't think that she would have followed any of that trajectory if she hadn't just randomly stumbled into my class, because nobody had ever said to her, hey, why don't you try a computer science class? I think you might like it. You know, it just had never, it had never been on her radar. It, you know, nobody, no advisor had ever suggested it to her. And I think that's because it seems so esoteric. You know, it's like, oh, computer science. And plus that's for boys. So I think we can make a big difference.
Well, that's good. That's good. How about, once again, as I look at your background, I see you have a strong passion for leadership development and diversity in academic leadership. So what can be done to meet the needs of emerging leaders at both colleges and universities?
Yeah, so I think you know, I think this is something that every institution ideally would have some leadership development programs that are designed for people at all levels. I didn't think of myself as a leader until I was probably in my 40s, which is crazy looking back on it, because I think I always had a set of skills that are exactly leadership skills, but I didn't think of it that way because I didn't have like that any formal title of, you know, manager or chair or whatever it was that I thought a leader was. And so I think I came very, very late to thinking about leadership, and maybe that's why I care so much about helping younger people and people at all stages to think about themselves as leaders, whether they're going to be on like a traditional, you know, management leadership path, or whether they just want to lead from wherever they are. So I think that we can think about infusing leadership into our professional development for faculty. We have an organization at Simmons called the Institute for Inclusive Leadership. And I've been talking with the director there about Simmons. We teach leadership, like we are leadership. That's one of our shticks, right? Is all of our students get leadership experience and leadership development. But we haven't turned that inside as much as I might have thought we would. And so I think there's like this great opportunity for us to think more about how to do that at home. I made a list of things that I've done this week related to leadership. I'm helping to coordinate the third proposal house at Simmons, which is a set of events that we've been doing to encourage faculty to seek outside funding and kind of grow their research program that way, which is its own form of kind of research leadership. I'm launching a little leadership book club within my college for a few faculty who have expressed an interest in that. And we're going to be reading a great book called Crucial Conversations, which is one of my favorite leadership books. I didn't give a talk yesterday, but I was asked if they could reuse a talk that I had given on diversity in data science. That's talking about not just that issue, but how can you make a difference in that issue? So I had a recorded talk that was given yesterday. And then later this week, I'll be doing a women's mentoring session and a lunch with a fellow session at AAAI, which is the Association for Advancement of AI National Conference. So like, that's just this week. So what can we do? We can do a lot. Like we can be present and pay attention and provide people with smaller and larger opportunities for leadership training. And I think, you know, some of these, like the ACE Fellowship, that's a big thing. That's a huge investment. That was a major experience for me. But a lot of those kinds of lessons I've also gotten through conversations with colleagues and just informal mentoring by senior people, the president of UMBC, Freeman Hrabowski, would sometimes just sit with me and talk with me for an hour about something I was going through or a question that I had, and just like share his knowledge and his wisdom with me. And so I think, you know, sharing our knowledge and wisdom and being willing to talk about our successes and our failures openly is really important. And not everybody necessarily finds the time to do that. And I think it's really important.
You know, I do too. I think at my age, I've been in the university system since for about 25 years before I'm doing this now. And it was obvious as I moved up through the ranks from faculty to department chair to associate dean to dean, there was no leadership training on anything. You just kind of did it. And I think it's wonderful that we're finally starting to go, you know, let's spend some time, as you said, you know, let's be a mentor, even if it's in an unofficial role, shadowing other individuals, sitting down and just talking to them. I think that's a wonderful idea. I think that will really make an impact of the future leaders. And I am going to probably down the road, not today, because we're kind of running a little bit out of time, but I'm going to have to chase your fellowship. I'm going to have to find out more about the ACE Fellowship because, you know, as I go through, there's two or three of you that I'm going to be talking to that have gone through there. I think you're in the same cohort
Yeah, that's right. John and I were listening
to it. And so it's like, I really, you know, you guys touch on it and you just mentioned it was a wonderful experience. And it sure sounds like such a detailed experience. You almost have to give an entire podcast to it. So absolutely. I think I'm going to need to revisit that. Here's one more question for you. And that's the big one, because it's a crystal ball kind of view. And how do you see higher ed evolving over the next 5 to 10 years from where we are today?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's all this changing demographics, and you know, the number of traditional college age 18 to 20 year olds is declining, and that's absolutely true, particularly in New England. So we're going to see some shifting demographics. I think the conversation about free college tuition and whether that really takes root and whether that happens at public universities and not privates is going to shift the landscape quite a lot. But, you know, all these things change and evolve over time. And I think the biggest thing is that this pandemic year, if nothing else, has taught all of us how to be flexible and resilient, and has taught us of the many different ways that we can provide a high quality education to our students. I think it's expanded many people's thinking about the nature of online learning. And so I think we're going to see more hybrid opportunities, more ways for students to be on campus and online, to kind of combine those modalities in different ways, and probably to provide students with a wider range of educational opportunities and different ways, like you mentioned, with certificates and kind of stackable credentials, and thinking about how to create that landscape in a way that serves everybody well, and has some commonality. You know, marketplaces are kind of scattered for a long time until some common views emerge. And I think we're in a little bit of a scattered space right now. There's a lot of different things happening. What will emerge, I think, will be a clearer understanding of how students can benefit from different kinds of education. I personally do not think that traditional on-campus residential college is going away anytime soon. I just think that experience has so much value for students, not so much because their classes are in a lecture hall, but, you know, it's because they're all coming together as a community that's centered around learning and growth. And just every conversation that you have, whether it's dropping in on office hours or sitting in the hallway with another student or running into somebody in line at the coffee shop, you know, it's that community. And by the way, I think that's why diversity is so important for us. Simmons is really working to think about how we increase diversity and how we become a more and more inclusive campus. I think we're already a very inclusive place, but you know, to really be inclusive and welcoming for everybody lets you create that kind of community where people can learn from each other, from different kinds of people across socioeconomic and racial boundaries. And that's what we strive to do. So online, on the ground, all of the above, flexibility and adaptability. That's where we're headed.
Excellent point. Well, Marie, thanks so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
Me too. Thanks a lot for having me, Dave.
Well, that ends today's show. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, and make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com for additional information. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Until next time.